Okay, so this is supposed to be a half an hour talk that is supposed to end at 1:45, and I really want us to be done on time. So I'm going to kind of fly through this, but please.
And Nancy, I built in a little cushion there, so you're okay.
All right. Super. And I took sort of the fun stuff out of this. This was going to be a bucket list that was going to include my personal real bucket list, but because of the format today, it doesn't. This is going to be, and you'll see what the bucket list refers to in a minute, but why we're focusing on the induction of labor patients. I hope we've teed this up well, but let's just go through it. There are maternal risks associated with cesarean section. We chatted about those a bit before: hysterectomy, postpartum hemorrhage, VTE, wound complication, decreased success at breastfeeding. We did not mention hospital readmission. Obviously, in future pregnancies, uterine rupture, planning and timing and route of the next pregnancy, and placenta accreta. And so clearly, if we can avoid the first C-section, we've avoided all those future risks. Paper came out in July in the Green Journal. The next four slides relate to the data on this, and this looks at the issue of labor induction and the rate of primary cesarean section. With 7,800 TSV patients, there was a 40% induction rate. I think our numbers, as you've just seen, sort of mimic that in some of the hospitals. 41% of the women who were induced had cervical ripening done. That was significantly different that reached significance. And the indications for induction, and as you can see here, are for fetal indications, fetal macrosomia, and those of you who are on the 39-week project, I'm sure know, yes. In fact, Jessica's right. The Green Journal is Obstetrics and Gynecology. Fetal macrosomia has not been shown to be an indication for cesarean for induction of labor. It doesn't change the outcome whatsoever. Maternal indications, what people called post-term, but it was less than 41 weeks, and they're therefore not truly post-term, and post-term, but 41 weeks or greater. Totally elective cesarean sections at about 25%. And of those elective patients, fully a third of them had to have cervical ripening for a Bishop score of less than six. So if you look for the indications for cesarean section out of this group that had that they were looking at, three-quarters of them had labor dystocia. I think our numbers in our group that you just showed, Kate, was something like 35%. Non-reassuring fetal status was 28%, maternal indications was 1.6%, and other was 2.9%. But if you look at induced versus spontaneous labor, there's about a 15% increase over 68.9% who went into who were sectioned for labor dystocia. In other words, the increase from 68 to 79%. Is about 15% of 68%. I think this pretty well shows that we're not as good as nature is for getting women into spontaneous or into labor. When they looked at the adjusted odds ratio, so again, if you look at this, if you take the referent population has an odds ratio of 1 in the first instance here, it says black race, the women who were black had a 44% greater risk of C-section than the white women they were referred to. Maternal age is a better predictor than, or better risk factor than ethnicity. BMI, as we showed earlier, as your BMI goes up, your rate of cesarean section significantly goes up. Large weight gain, so as we're looking at patient education issues, we can certainly be reiterating the IOM recommendations regarding weight gain. That has as big of a predictor for cesarean section as does gestational diabetes and hypertension, being truly post-AIDS, and more important than any of those things are induced labor. So we do an awful lot of inductions to for women who are gestational diabetics, and in fact, what we're doing is increasing their risk overall of a cesarean section just by the mere induction, for instance. So important to keep in mind that our medical intervention in some cases is making things worse. When they took that data and did a multivariate analysis, so they controlled for all the significant factors and compared them back and forth, again, the induced labor was significantly more of a risk factor than anything else. So I think we can understand from their data that about 20% of all cesarean sections among low-risk women and all NTSV women could be attributed just to the labor induction. That's how they work through that. I'm gonna, Dr. Meeks, your question is there a value in delaying inductions for postnates to 42 weeks without a significant rise in neonatal complications? There's lots of different papers on that, and I believe the last committee opinion from the Committee on Obstetrics from ACOG was that the risk-benefit ratio is on the side of delivery at 41 and not waiting till 42. But most certainly with an informed patient, she could, with appropriate antenatal testing, continue on to 42 weeks. But in general, I think the recommendation, the data weighs on getting her delivered around 41. Do elective inductions for multiparous patients contribute to the increased C-section rate? They do a bit. Although when we look back at the PICNIC data from the under 39 weeks project and compared, I did this on a spot check on a couple of hospitals that I went and gave talks to, their induction, successful induction rates for their multips was pretty darn good. So you'd have to do a lot of those to see a problem. In general, we're pretty good at getting multiparous women who have delivered vaginally before to deliver vaginally. This is a second paper by Zhang that looked at the contemporary cesarean delivery practice in the United States. This is from a very interesting group called the Consortium on Safe Labor, and about 5 or 6 years ago, the NICHD sent out a request for hospitals using electronic medical records to just dump their prenatal or their intrapartum records into a common database, and they now have literally hundreds of thousands of births that they look at and have real-time. You know, not a randomized trial, but this is how we're all taking care of patients, boots on the ground. There's some very interesting data coming out of this, including the one that Kate referenced a couple of minutes ago about the change in the Friedman's curve to something that's a little bit more realistic. Anyway, Zhang et al. Just in August of this year took this huge database, studied more than 200,000 women who were delivering after 23 weeks where the intention at the beginning of their labor process was to deliver vaginally. They had about a 30% induction rate, and in those 36% induction rate, and of those who had intended vaginal birth, the induction rate was 44%. Let me restate that. Overall, of the 200,000 births, there was a 36% induction rate, but if you just looked at those with an intended vaginal birth, it was about 44%. The C-section rate ranged from 20 to 44%, with about the national average of about 30.5%. Again, you can see the differences in the C-section rate was about twice what it was if you were induced versus spontaneous labor. And if you honed that down among the NTSV group, the C-section rate for induced women was 31%, and for those in spontaneous labor, 14%, so a little over twice the risk. Again, a theme coming out here. The indications, about a third were repeat elective C-sections, 47% for CPD or failure to progress, 27% for non-reassuring fetal heart tones. About half of them were done less than 6 centimeters. One of the next papers we're going to review as a group here is this paper in December regarding when is active labor. One third of them were done with a second stage less than 3 hours. We don't know if all of those had non-reassuring fetal status or exactly what, but it certainly was not consistent with the guidelines for how long second stages should be, and 1/4 of the multips done less than 2 hours. And as the slide points out, this includes that 30-minute decision to incision time. And people pulled the plug on the C-section for induced versus spontaneous labors at an earlier gestational cervical dilation. Canadian study of C-section rates over time in Nova Scotia, again, this looked at thousands and thousands of women, and what they found that almost 2/3 of their overall C-section rate was attributable to three things that they felt you could potentially modify. So as you're looking for action plans in your hospital, these are the ones that they suggested, some of which, I mean, the last two don't apply to our project at all, but may apply to your hospital for other things. In the avoiding, in the NTSV group, induced labor is certainly one of them. If you've got a previous C-section and a singleton, provide VBAC information and encouragement if you're able to do that, and offer external cephalic version for your breeches. And other than that, they really found there was not a whole lot that was modifiable. So, again, pushing us towards looking at this induced labor piece. So here are my buckets. As I kind of looked at what happens when a patient is coming, is approaching her delivery time, there's basically four buckets of factors that I kind of think about together. One of them I kind of grouped as patient education. And in your practices, which would include the physician practices, nurse midwifery practices, where patients are getting their prenatal care, I think, and as well as the hospital-based group, it's important to establish your practice agreements about it, elective inductions and indicated inductions, who you're going to do, when you're going to do them, how you're going to do them, and to make sure that you communicate early on in your prenatal care the policy of preferring that women go into spontaneous labor with an essential ban on elective inductions prior to 39 weeks. And I would say that it is way too late at 38 weeks to start that conversation with patients and expect them to buy into it. So from a systems-based approach, making sure that women are aware of this early on in the process and not when they have the discomforts of late pregnancy. For all labors, some of the other systems-based questions that make an impact on cesarean section rates include what sort of analgesia is available and how and when is it administered in labor. I'm sorry, that's my beeper. Hold on. Epidurals do not seem to delay or affect the labor curve as much as we once thought they were, although there's some debate about that, but certainly there needs to be some standard around that. What sort of labor support is available? Do you have doulas? Is there one-on-one nursing for patients being induced? Do you allow acupuncture? You know, just what sort of different things are available? This next one is one that I have heard as I've traveled around the state, that there seems to be a disconnect between the unit's physician, midwifery, and nursing staff sharing a commitment to promoting safe vaginal birth for patients for whom there is no contraindication. I hear at one hospital that the docs can predict whether a patient's going to have a C-section based on which nurse is laboring her. And I hear other facilities telling me that the nurses know right off the top that certain docs have very high section rates and very low thresholds for doing sections. So they're within a particular unit, there seems to be that some work that can be done. And then what labor curve do you use in your unit, and how do you functionally define failure to progress? If you're really going to say you're inducing someone and you only give them to 3 centimeters dilated before you say they haven't progressed, you've got a IUPC in, but they don't get to 200 milliunits, I think there's good data to say you're not really using common standards for what failure to progress is, and your unit should probably have that conversation. In women in spontaneous labor, again, what's the functional definition? Kate's data that she showed for the aggregate was that there were lots of women who were admitted, according to the data presented so far, in active labor, but they were less than 3 centimeters dilated. Or they, you know, were zero and hadn't changed their cervix, which is, of course, part of the definition of labor. What do you do with the patient who's in prodromal labor, who's bounced in and out of labor and delivery for 24 hours every few hours with contractions? Do you send her home? Do you give her a therapeutic rest? Do you feel like you need to induce her? Again, maybe having that conversation, as well as how and when do you augment labor, if labor needs to be augmented. And then for the induced labor, who gets induced? Do you have a policy in your practice and labor unit regarding elective inductions? When do you do inductions? What methods of cervical ripening do you use? Who gets that? And what are your Pitocin protocols? Are all part of the different buckets of interventions and decision points that can affect your NTSV value. So these are just some ideas for quality projects around inductions of labor related to the bucket list, just to get people thinking, and you may already have major decisions about what you're going to be doing, but these were some that I just am throwing out there. Number one, know what your vaginal delivery rate is in your NTSV population. What are your key drivers of your induction of labor rates? Who's making those decisions? Are they consistent across the board? What are the key drivers of your success rates? What are you doing well at your hospital? Those hospitals in our data set that have a 10% and section rate in your nulliparous patients, what are you doing well there? What changes can you actually figure out and design, vet with all your stakeholders, and then test in 1 to 2 to 3 months to see if it makes a difference? Are there 2 to 4 changes in these drivers that you want to look at? And if there are issues in your spontaneously laboring patients, we don't want to say you can't look at them, but you might want to, you know, go ahead and look at your spontaneous folks as well, even though we're encouraging you to spend some time, for reasons I hope I've made clear, on your induction of labor patients. So that's the tee up for the IOL folks and why we're emphasizing it. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Going forward, it was hard to